Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, New Folsom Prison near Sacramento is known as one of the state's most dangerous, both because it houses people convicted of some of the most serious crimes and because corrections officers are more likely than at other state prisons to use serious force and cause severe injury to incarcerated people there. A new season of KQED's On Our Watch podcast takes a closer look at conditions in New Folsom and what happened when two whistleblowers tried to expose the abuse and corruption they saw there before their deaths. We learn more after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When Valentina Rodriguez, a corrections officer, was promoted to an elite investigative unit at California's New Folsom Prison in 2018, he was excited to be there, but soon found himself navigating a notoriously difficult environment with violent offenders and violent fellow officers. New Folsom's use of force rate against the incarcerated is 40% higher than at other prisons, and workers who raise alarms can be subjected to hazing or abuse. Still, Rodriguez reported the misconduct he saw by officers in his unit. Days later, he was dead. A new season of KQED's On Our Watch podcast investigates whether there's a connection here and takes a closer look at what goes on behind the walls of New Folsom, known officially as California State Prison, Sacramento. And a warning to listeners, descriptions of violence and suicide will be part of today's show. If you find you need support, text 988. Joining me now is Suki Lewis, host of On Our Watch, also criminal justice reporter for KQED. Suki, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. So thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. Julie Small is also with us, also reporter on Our Watch, who reports criminal justice for KQED as well. Julie, really good to have you, too.
Thank you, Mina.
And Julie, start by painting a fuller picture for me of New Folsom. Who is there? Its reputation?
Mm-hmm. Well, it got its name because it was actually built right next to the old Folsom, and the one that was made famous by Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison Blues, where he performed it and everything. Yeah. But eventually it became its own separate prison. That's how it got the name New Folsom. And it has a separate mission. It is one of the 10 high security prisons in California, where the mission is the people that are there are some of the most dangerous, most violent male prisoners and in the system. And also a lot of people that are there suffer from acute mental illnesses. So it's that combination of trying to provide a high level of mental health care in an environment where the risks are very high because the people that are in the prison have histories of violence.
So the people within the prison, the population that is incarcerated there, some of the most serious crimes, some of the most severe medical issues. What about the guards? Use of force, serious use of force incidents, Julie?
They are dealing with a very high rate of staff assaults. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah, there are many more staff assaults at this prison as well. And that definitely wears down on correctional officers that we spoke with for this podcast. You have to be constantly on alert, and it creates a really volatile, I think, situation when there's that much risk on both sides.
And also use of force by officers, prison officers.
Right. Well, I think I'll pass it to Suki because she has analyzed the data very closely on use of force at New Folsom.
Suki, talk about some of the data that really stood out to you when you took a closer look at New Folsom.
Yeah, well, that's part of why we started looking at this prison in particular, is because there was this new transparency law that opened up use of force records across California prisons. And that's for serious use of force incidents. So use of force incidents in which someone is really badly injured or they use deadly force. So, you know, shootings and stuff like that. And there were just so many more of these incidents at this prison. Three times more of these really serious incidents were happening at New Folsom. And it was like, okay, what is going on at this prison? And then we expanded it out and started to look at, you know, overall use of force numbers. So that includes not as serious incidents, you know, pepper spray incidents, use of batons, you know, where people are not necessarily seriously injured. And even in that kind of broader category of use of force, we found on average, you know, from 2009 to last year, 2023, the last year we had data for, that it was 40% higher than any other prison in the state. That includes, you know, all the high security prisons like Julie was talking about. And so it just seems like there's something, you know, going on at this prison. And, you know, it has to do likely with the population, but also with, you know, the officers that are there, you know, just from, you know, a lot of officers that we have spoken to have said that they witnessed excessive use of force and, you know, did not report it because the culture there was not to report. So that's, you know, the focus of our series and our reporting.
Help me understand what the rules are supposed to be around officer use of force, corrections officer use of force.
So, you know, use of force is allowed, you know, the same as for police officers, you know, to stop a deadly threat. So, for instance, if you have an incarcerated person who is attacking another incarcerated person or an officer, it's totally appropriate to use force to stop, you know, stop that. You know, there's some use of force that is allowed, you know, to overcome resistance, you know, so that, you know, depending on how you define that, but there's a lot of, like, a lot of the cases that we saw where it was like the incarcerated person was resisting being moved from one place to another. But you're only allowed to use, like, the lowest level of use of force necessary to overcome that resistance or to stop that threat. And then this, you know, the moment where that resistance stops, you know, the incarcerated person says, okay, I'll go along with you, or, you know, relaxes, you're supposed to stop using force. And what we found is that it appears like a number of incidents where the use of force did not stop at that point, like that continued, you know, perhaps in a retaliatory fashion, which is what we heard from a lot of incarcerated people who experienced these incidents. And, you know, this is where it gets into kind of the violation of the policy around use of force.
Did you find use of force, serious use of force, common across the worker population, or that it was a smaller group of people that tended to be the ones who were using force?
You know, that's a really great question, Mina. And, you know, again, with the broader use of force numbers, it's difficult because we don't have the names of those officers who used force. But within the category that were opened up, the serious use of force cases, yeah, you know, it was a much smaller number. And I think that's really important, you know, to say that not all, you know, correctional officers are involved in these really serious incidents, and not all correctional officers are, you know, using too much force or whatever. But there was this kind of group, I would say, that were repeat offenders. So we saw them involved in multiple incidents, and the descriptions that we were finding on the reports that they wrote just, like, didn't make sense, didn't match. You know, so they would say, like, oh, I guided this person to the ground, you know, and then they would end up in the hospital with a broken femur. And it was like, that doesn't compute. That is not a use of force that would result in that injury. So what's going on? Where is the disconnect?
We're talking about abuse and corruption in California's New Folsom Prison that my guests Suki Lewis and Julie Small traced, dug into, found out from data that they were able to obtain, and have put out a new season of the podcast On Our Watch, where they describe their findings. And you, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. What are your reactions or questions to what you're hearing? Do you have an experience with our state prison system? Is what they're saying resonating with you? 866-733-6786 is the number. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email forum@kqed.org, or you can find us on our social channels. We're at KQED Forum. Julie, you also found that there was an under-documentation of incidents where use of force was used against incarcerated people. And in fact, you were able to gather some tape. These were interviews from CDCR of incarcerated people at New Folsom telling investigators who claimed officer use of force. Do you want to say a little bit more about the cut that we're about to hear?
These are the audio that you're about to hear comes from these disciplinary hearings that occur when an officer is accused of excessive force. All the people involved in the incident are interviewed. And these have been private. They've been something that we haven't been able to look into. I've been reporting on prison since 2007, and it's just since 2019 that this kind of information on disciplinary processes became public, and that has been a big focus of KQED and certainly Suki Lewis's work has been to get those files and analyze those files, and that's where this comes from.
Let's hear it.
They would cuff us. They would handcuff us and beat us.
I was handcuffed as I am now.
With my hands behind my back, still handcuffed, and my legs.
He was escorting me with his right hand.
And then I seen him coming at me. And before I knew it,
I was forced to the ground.
And then they threw me in the cage.
And that's how they broke my back.
Thought I was going to die. I felt like I was dying, man.
I was just like, you know what? I'm not going to say nothing. If I did, they're going to beat me again. I might die this time.
Suki, in addition to that tape, you also interviewed a dozen men or so who were incarcerated at New Folsom. What did they tell you about how often the incidents that happened to them are at least documented, or there is an interview?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there is this rule that they're supposed to do this use of force interview within 48 hours. So to document on camera if an incarcerated person, you know, says that excessive force was used against them or if they got badly injured. But the OIG, the Office of Inspector General of Prisons, actually released a report, I think it was 2 years ago, in which they really criticized CDCR and said they were only doing these interviews about half the time when they're supposed to do them every time. And what we were hearing from incarcerated people is that on top of that, like, it can be, you know, scary and dangerous for them to make reports. And so sometimes they also didn't feel like they could say what had happened to them because they were afraid of retaliation. And then it goes kind of a layer beyond that, which is, you know, if these cases, you know, don't get documented, you know, if the incarcerated person isn't brought to the hospital, like one of the voices that you heard in that montage is this man, Mario Gonzalez, and they didn't bring him to the hospital. And so it didn't turn up as a case of, you know, use of force resulting in great bodily injury because they didn't diagnose that his back had been broken until a year later. So there's just kind of a black hole that some of these incidents can fall into.
We're talking about the conditions in California's New Folsom Prison with KQED's Suki Lewis and Julie Small. Suki is host of On Our Watch, a new award-winning podcast that has a new season. It's an award-winning podcast by KQED that examines accountability in law enforcement. Julie Small is also a reporter for On Our Watch. We'll have more with them and with you after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. New Folsom Prison near Sacramento is known as one of the state's most dangerous, and a new season of KQED's On Our Watch podcast takes a closer look at conditions in New Folsom and what happened when two whistleblowers tried to expose abuse and corruption there. Suki Lewis is host and reporter for On Our Watch. Julie Small is a reporter for On Our Watch as well. They're both criminal justice reporters for KQED. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation with your questions for our reporters about conditions in California's prison and especially at New Folsom. Maybe you are an officer who has worked at a prison and has an experience to share, an incarcerated person or a friend or family member of an incarcerated person who would also like to share your experience with California's prison system. Maybe you've been a whistleblower. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you'd like to share your thoughts or questions, you can email them to forum@kqed.org. You can post them on X, Instagram, on our digital community on Discord. We're at KQED Forum. I want to ask you, Julie, what was CDCR's reaction when you presented them with some of the findings that you made about New Folsom?
Well, that's kind of interesting because they basically said, we don't agree. The New Folsom has got the same level of use of force as other prisons in the same high security mission. And then they said, well, we'd have to look at your data. Where did you get your data? And Suki Lewis was there in this interview, and she said, oh, we got the data from you. It's your data. And they said they would take a closer look at it, this press person. And but then they said they couldn't comment on it and they couldn't provide an analysis. So really, they haven't engaged with us about the findings on use of force other than to say we neither agree nor disagree with what you're saying.
Suki, anything you'd add about CDCR's reaction?
Yeah, well, I just think it's very frustrating to me and to Julie. You know, we went on a tour of the prison in which they told us, you know, that the use of force there was in line with other prisons across the state. That was, you know, over 9 months ago. And we followed up multiple times, you know, asking for their analysis, like, what, you know, what do you make of this? Like, where are we getting something wrong? And they just refused to engage with us. And I just think it's really important, you know, both for understanding the root causes of, you know, what's going on in this prison and across prisons, but also for understanding, you know, how the higher ups, how the leadership at these prisons view it and what they're doing about it. And so I just find it very frustrating. And I think it's really important, you know, that potentially, you know, the legislature, you know, other oversight bodies, you know, take a look specifically at this prison and then also at overall use of force rates. Because our data we found since 2009, again, to last year, which is the last year we have data for, use of force rates are going up across all of California's high security prisons. They've increased 137%, you know, which I think was a little bit surprising to us because there has been so much talk around, you know, California prison reform and, yes, and things like that. So I would really like, you know, serious minds to engage with us on this and see what's going on.
Well, we actually met with the Inspector General for Prisons and asked, you know, well, have you noticed how different this prison is, how much more use of force there is? And the answer was, well, we do have a lot of work at that prison, but there wasn't a sense that they could proceed on their own to do an independent investigation. That would be something that would need to come from the California State Legislature. And I wonder why that hasn't happened yet, given that you have two whistleblowers who died at this prison. That's very unusual. And both of them were not just correctional officers on the front line. These were correctional officers inside the Investigative Services Unit, which is like the police force for the prison. They investigate crimes at the prison. They have access to a lot of information. So for them to come forward and then to be ignored, it's really appalling.
Well, yes, there were corrections officers who tried to blow the whistle on misconduct at New Folsom. And one of them was Valentino Rodriguez. He did this in 2020 and then was found dead days later. The official cause of death was ruled a fentanyl overdose. But as my guests on our watch, Hosuki Lewis and reporter Julie Small, make clear in their podcast, Valentino Rodriguez's family, especially his father, Val Sr., aren't satisfied with how his death was investigated. And I want to bring him into the conversation now. Valentino Rodriguez Sr., thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
So I understand Val's move to New Folsom was a big promotion, and especially the move to that elite investigative unit in 2018. He was really proud of it at the time, right?
Yeah, he told me right away, and he was excited about it. I asked him what the job description was like, and he told me it was going to be a little less violence where he was at. Mm-hmm. He would go down if there was a criminal crime down there and investigate and work from there. But he wasn't actually walking you know, the hallways anymore, dealing with the inmates one-on-one as much.
So he thought it would be a bit of a reprieve from the violence. Can you talk about what his experience actually was when he got there, the culture of the unit as well?
Well, I mean, he was ostracized right away. He was given an extra heavy load of work all the time. He was asked to do pull-ups, get on a scale. Like I had said, his first day there on the job, when he came home, I asked him, how was the first day? And he said, they asked me who the F I was. Mm. So I knew right there, well, you know, maybe this is some kind of an entry thing where it was hard for me to comprehend, because this is like a state job. It's a very important job, and it's an elite group of people, you know, they're appointed. So I was like, wow, you know, but I figured, you know, maybe there's some kind of little, I don't know, initiation thing. He is new. He is very young. You know, I considered that, but mostly I considered that the higher ups, the supervisors, the management there, if they caught on to something like this, or they wouldn't allow this, eventually this would be controlled if it got out of hand.
Tell us about Val Jr. What was his personality?
He's had the same personality he did as a boy, you know, always wanting to help his dad, show his dad something, you know. He grew up to be that way with all of the people that employed him, including me. When he worked for me, he was always like working beyond his scope and working hard. He was very, he used to encourage me a lot as a son. He'd come in and maybe give me advice. He just used to work really hard. He was always happy, you know, and still had a really boyish, childlike attitude about things, you know. He'd come over. I remember when he first worked at San Quentin, he came over in his uniform and he put on cartoons, and he was sitting on the couch, and I tell my wife, look at this guy, he's watching hardened criminals and he's watching cartoons. He's sandwiched, but that was my son, you know. That's the way he was. He's very had a very innocent nature about him.
What kind of changes did you notice come over him as he worked in that investigative unit?
He just became a little more serious. He would drift off, you know. He would kind of stare into space for a little bit. When he came over to hang out at functions, sometimes I couldn't find him. So I'd look around, he'd be upstairs by himself. And I would tell him, hey, come down. And he'd always use the same excuse. Oh, I have a headache, Dad. But sometimes Mimi would say, Val, go get Val. He's over here and upstairs, or he's over there in the other room.
Yeah, his wife. Yeah. So, girlfriend at the time, but yeah.
Yeah. So he started to be that way. I remember when he first started the job, he was very compassionate about the inmates. And he'd get upset if he saw the guys or other officers bothering inmates for no reason. I noticed later on he began to become a little less compassionate.
Noticed
on text messages, his language got a little bit, you know. I look at some of his text messages and I kind of, yeah, it's, you know. So he had some slight changes. I think he was struggling with those because overall, whenever I seen him, he was smiling and he was happy. He's really happy to be around his siblings and family all the time.
Suki, Val Sr. mentions text messages. Val Sr. gave you access to Val Jr.'s phone. You were able to see some of the kinds of texts, the harassment that other officers were using against him. Can you talk a little bit about that, what the phones showed you? What the phone messages showed you?
Yeah, we did. You know, thank you to Val Sr. for, you know, trusting us with it and being willing to share, you know, someone's phone, you know, with us, which in this day and age is kind of like getting at least a partial view into a big portion of their life. And what we saw was, you know, really, you know, pretty negative language, slurs, homophobic slurs, racial slurs being used between this cadre of officers. And, you know, I've heard from other officers, like, it's a prison, you know, we use bad language regarding these terrible people, you know, it's not that big a deal. But I think it really matters the context in which it's used. And if you know, listening to Val Sr., you hear about this young officer who's really trying to fit in with this other group of officers. You know, he's trying, eager to please, eager to kind of make friends. And in response, they're calling him homophobic slurs and mocking his weight and engaging in very negative, exclusionary conduct towards him that wasn't just limited to those text messages. Like, that was just an example of what he was enduring. And I think it really took a psychological toll on him over time. And one of the things that we've heard, you know, more broadly from, you know, the mental health field is just how protective it can be to be part of a team, like how that can, when you're dealing with a dangerous environment, a difficult environment, how, you know, soldiers talk about, you know, having their fellow, you know, fellows in arms can really be a protective factor. And so I think that not having that protective factor, and in fact having the opposite, you can really see it, you know, taking a toll on Valentino Rodriguez and other officers that we've talked to.
The other thing about those text messages is that his supervisors were often included in these group texts. So he knew that he couldn't turn to them and say, hey, I really hate this. You got to do something. They were either silently condoning it or participating in it.
So then Val Jr. eventually went to the warden of the entire prison, since his own supervisors were not responding in any way, to try to talk about the personal harassment he was facing. What happened?
Well, he was actually first talked to the associate, the chief deputy warden. They have all these titles. He talked to her. He broke down at work. This was in January of 2020. And he said he just couldn't take it anymore. He had developed all these symptoms. He was throwing up before his shifts. He was having daily panic attacks. This is Gina Jones, the chief deputy warden, convinced him to, he wanted to quit. She said, don't quit, just go out on leave and, you know, take a break and get some help and maybe come back later and keep your benefits. That kind of put, one of the problems with that was that it was then never recorded as, like, he went out because of a hostile work environment. Instead, it was recorded he went out because he was suffering from PTSD for an earlier incident. And as far as we know, the associate warden did nothing with this information, didn't report it, didn't stop it, and has been promoted to become a warden of her own prison in Stockton.
But eventually, he is called back, right, Suki, to meet with the warden, the head of the whole prison, right? Can you talk about what he was asked to share at that meeting?
Yes. Yeah, so this was in October of 2020, and it was this meeting that happened right before he died. And he went into this meeting because he had shared, you know, some of what he had been experiencing with a supervisor there who finally did do the right thing and did take it to the warden and reported, you know, that he was talking about all this, you know, the harassment and also the slurs that had been used against him. And so he goes in for this meeting with the warden. And from what we understand, he shared a lot of, you know, the treatment that he had been experiencing, but he also shared other allegations of misconduct about the ISU. And these allegations were even more serious. They involved allegations that other officers in the ISU were planting contraband, drugs, potentially weapons, potentially on incarcerated people. And he makes these allegations. He leaves the prison. You know, we talked to his wife, who said that day he actually came home and seemed really relieved, like he trusted that this was going to be handled, and it was like a big weight had been lifted off of him. But then over the next few days, he starts to get, well, this is about I don't know, about 5 or 6 days later, he gets a few calls and text messages that show him that the word is out, that he has made these reports, that he's a whistleblower. And he was really scared about that. And what we know is that there was this search that was done. So the warden ordered the supervisors in the ISU to search desks for this, you know, alleged contraband. And this was kind of an odd way to handle this, because this could result, you know, planted drugs and weapons that could result in overturning criminal cases or even criminal charges for officers if they're doing this. And the warden calls for a kind of casual search of their desks by their own supervisors. And we've heard differing stories about what was found during this search. Officially, only one weapon was found, and it was, you know, supposed to be a training item. But we have heard from two other sources, you know, that there were things found during this search and that it was kind of swept under the rug. Yeah. So, Go ahead, Bill.
I'm sorry. According to Kevin's book, there was a whole bag of goodies in there, you know.
A whole bag of goodies there. Sorry, I cut you off there, Val.
It was weapons and drugs inside of a bag that Kevin had seen.
And we can talk more about Kevin after the break. First, I just, you know, as Suki mentioned, about 6 days after that meeting with the warden, Val, your son died and the coroner ruled his death an accidental fentanyl overdose. But I know that you believe that it wasn't just fentanyl that killed your son. What else do you feel like caused or contributed to his death?
Well, the odd thing is when we first went in there, it was a crime scene and we had to leave. And then we couldn't get the phone for almost over a week, and we couldn't get an actual death certificate for months. So I just felt at first it was a crime scene. I just feel that poison it's just too coincidental for me, to swallow, you know, he was a witness. Especially to the Aguilar incident.
Mm. Yeah, you're bringing up a lot of things that I want to dig into right after the break. The Aguilar incident, Kevin, or Kevin Steele. It's all talked about in a new podcast by On Our Watch called On Our Watch New Folsom. The host is Suki Lewis. Julie Small is also a reporter on Our Watch as well, and they are both my guests today. We'll have more of them and with you after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A new season of KQED's award-winning podcast, On Our Watch, looks at a pattern of abuse and corruption at New Folsom Prison and traces the stories of whistleblowers who tried to bring it to light. Suki Lewis is host and reporter of On Our Watch, also criminal justice reporter for KQED. Julie Small is a reporter on Our Watch and a criminal justice reporter for KQED as well. Valentino Rodriguez Sr. is also with us. He's father of Valentino Rodriguez Jr., a whistleblower who worked at New Folsom Prison as a corrections officer and died in 2020. And you, our listeners, are sharing your thoughts and questions about the findings that Julie and Suki uncovered as part of their podcast. Diane writes, I was a volunteer Buddhist chaplain at New Folsom from 2007 until COVID lockdown. There were too many incidents of undue force to relate, but here's one that sticks in my mind. Someone inadvertently set off an alarm in the chapel where there is no air conditioning. In the summer, it could easily be 115 degrees inside. Guards burst in. I explained there was no incident, but they told all the men to go to the floor. One man didn't do it quickly enough and was shoved down, his arm twisted around his back until he cried out. I protested and was essentially told to mind my own business. So, Suki, just before the break, Val was mentioning the Aguilar incident. Can you talk about the incident of the murder of the incarcerated man Luis Giovanni Aguilar? And I understand that Val Jr. had surveillance camera video of this incident on his phone. Tell us about what happened.
Yes. So on December 12th, 2019, there was this incident that happened in the long-term restricted housing unit, which is a SHU unit, so very, very high security. It's often, you know, for people who have committed new crimes in prison or who have been convicted of really serious crimes. And so they try to, it's you know, where it's solitary housing mostly, and you're under escort anytime you go anywhere. And they had this day room program there where you could come out and you could use the day room, but you would be, you know, shackled to your chair. And then you could watch TV or participate in a group or something like that. But this was kind of an unusual new program for such a high security unit like that. And what happened on this day is that a man was brought down. His name is Luis Giovanni Aguilar. And he was shackled to a chair, and then these two other men were brought out into the day room, and they escaped their shackles, went up to retrieve some improvised weapons from the cell of a third man, came back down, and really brutally stabbed Aguilar to death. And it was a shocking thing to happen. It was shocking to happen in this particular unit because it is so high security and supposed to be under such close watch. And there were a lot of kind of rumors and allegations that began to bubble up after this incident because these same three guys, the two guys who participated in the stabbing and the third man whose the weapons they retrieved from his cell had been involved in a very, very similar incident that was an attempted murder about 2 months prior. And then there was a third incident that happened in between that was called this practice run, where these guys again escaped their shackles in this day room and went up and retrieved weapons from this man's cell. And so just the pattern of those events from correctional officers that we've spoken to is very suspicious. And, you know, the fact that this incident went on for a really long time and no lethal force was used. So only the foam batons were used, not the lethal option of force to stop the attack.
And that was
so that's really, kind of. Yeah. Go ahead.
And Julie, that was really troubling to Val Jr., right? The way that the corrections officers responded.
Right. In fact, maybe Val Sr. wants to tell you because he was there when and Val Jr. was, got the video.
He was more upset about the tower. They weren't shooting lethal force. And he was saying, look at Dad. You know, he kept saying, this guy is a coward. He's supposed to be using lethal force. You know, they've been stabbing this guy for too long. You know, he's really upset about that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Val.
Yeah, I just looked at it, and, you know, it's like you see stuff on TV, and you just become, you know, so habituated to seeing things. I didn't understand, you know, the volume to all this at the time, because, you know, that wasn't my world, you know. That was what Val was part of as far as his job.
The person, Val, who helped you understand the volume of all this, as you say, was a fellow corrections officer named Kevin Steele. Can you tell us about Kevin and what Kevin told you about how what Val is observing here in this video is part of a larger problem?
Well, Kevin, I remember when Kevin and I first met and talked, he would always kind of dance around the subject of the B8 and Val being tied into writing this report.
About that incident, the Aguilar incident.
He considered Val a witness. And in that times, he told me that if Val was gone and then Kevin himself was gone, that this would all go away. And that seemed to be the focal point of everything for him. Was that B8 homicide.
And what was Kevin like? You two became good friends, right? Why did you trust him?
I didn't, I just, you know, at the time, there was really nobody to trust, or no, I couldn't get any answers. And, you know, like I told Kevin before, there's no playbook to this. I mean, I've never known of anybody this happened to, or so I got to the point after seeing him at the funeral initially, that I have to reach out to somebody. I'm going to start here, and I'm just going to navigate through this and just try to, you know, think ahead all the time. But I didn't have any reason not to trust him. You know, I was just confused all the time that he was speaking with me, and at the same time he was going to the prison and reporting what we were, you know, discussing. And I was, and they started to ostracize him. And I was thinking to myself, why would you think they're not going to ostracize you? He just really trusted the prison and the system that they were going to do something, and he was going to somehow help with that. And he found out shortly after that, you know, they weren't going to do anything. If anything, they were going to try to cover this all up. So they started to ostracize him, and he just kind of went, instead of it being 50-50, he just kind of went to one side and helped me all the time. Mm. I still understand how integrity he was. He didn't have to step forward and do this. You know, he could have been like the rest of those guys and just went on about his business. But I just think that he had been subject to so much stuff in the past that this was kind of one of the things, that the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, he had had enough.
Suki, Kevin felt strongly that officers had committed misconduct related to the Aguilar incident. And as Val's describing, he really believed that the system would do something about it once they, you know, heard the evidence and saw what had happened. But what did actually happen when Kevin tried to present this to the higher-ups?
Well, you know, in our episode that's actually out today, we dig into this because we were leaked some internal videos of the actual homicide and of the practice run, and we're able to kind of go through and analyze the failures that those videos show, and also hear testimony that Kevin got from the incarcerated people who were involved. And, you know, what they alleged was, you know, a pretty serious collaboration between officers and incarcerated people to participate in this murder, allow this murder to happen. The three men who I have also interviewed who were a part of the murder, who are incarcerated, all said that officers allowed them to do it and did this in two really key ways. One, that there was an agreement not to double lock their handcuffs. And so if the handcuffs are double locked, it makes them much more difficult to get out of, because there was a black box, which is like a transport box, over top of the cuff key. So it makes it very difficult in terms of tampering to get out of them. But if they're single locked, you can use a shim and basically bypass that whole transport security box apparatus. And the other way that these incarcerated men said that the officers helped them was that they had an agreement not to use deadly force. So they knew they were not going to get shot by the Mini 14 rifle. And so they continued with their brutal assault.
And I just want to add there that in these units, there are signs on the wall that say there are no warning shots. It's understood that if you use lethal force against another incarcerated person, that they have the right and the ability to use deadly force to stop you, real bullets, but they didn't do that.
Suki, Kevin Steele sent a memo about the investigative services unit corruption that he saw there to New Folsom's warden in 2021. You spoke with Kevin Steele's brother. Can you tell us what happened to Kevin?
Yes. So Kevin Steele left the prison in around December of 2020, so shortly after Valentino's death in October. He feels like he was really becoming frustrated with the lack of response that he felt from the prison. And this was a lack of response that went beyond Aguilar. It was also, you know, years of seeing use of force incidents go, you know, not uninvestigated, basically, and also the death of his good friend Valentino Rodriguez, and what he felt was a lack of, you know, accountability, a lack of response, and a lack of humanity towards the family that he would have expected in the wake of the death of an officer. And he was beginning to feel ostracized, as Val Sr. was talking about, and he moved across the country to Missouri. And his plan was to basically, you know, ride out his, he had tons of vacation and sick days that he had never used, and he was just going to ride that out for the year and then retire. But it was difficult, you know, even on the other side of the country, for him to let go of what was going on in the prison. And, you know, he was writing this book, he was researching, you know, ways to get whistleblower protections. He was, you know, working with Val Sr. still on trying to get accountability around Valentino's death and Valentino's treatment in the ISU. And so I think as hard as he tried to get away from it, he could not let it go. And he ended up dying by suicide in August of 2021.
We're talking with Suki Lewis and Julie Small about their podcast, On Our Watch. And let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Julie, you've reported on prisons for years. What has doing On Our Watch New Folsom helped you understand about what it's like to be a corrections officer?
It has really deepened my understanding of what that job is, and what correctional officers are up against, and the compromises that they need to make. Usually you don't get to talk to correctional officers at all. They're not allowed to talk to the press. It's against policy. But we were able to find people who had retired, people who knew Kevin and Valentino well, and were horrified by what had happened and want to see change. One of the things they talked about a lot was just like the psychological impact of being in the violent environment all the time. And in your career over many, you know, sometimes decades, you might see many murders happen right in front of you. And that there's a difficulty, though, in getting any kind of psychological help, that they're just kind of supposed to suck it up and keep going. It's very hard, even if they go out on leave, to get the help that they need. And sometimes that help is like, here's some pills, and it doesn't really get at the root problem. And they also feel, a lot of them expressed that they feel that the management, that the, you know, the head of corrections and the administrators don't really understand how it is to be on the front line and what they're dealing with every day. And they keep getting more and more, you know, orders about what to do and not to do, and at the same time, fewer staff. Like, one of the things about the Aguilar homicide is there used to be two people in the tower where they're guarding three different units at the same time. And now that day there was only one person up there. So like staff shortages and all these things that, you know, accumulate. And the other thing that I came to appreciate was talking to correctional officers who were completely against using unnecessary force. However, they knew that if they were to report their fellow officers, they would become ostracized, their job would become more dangerous. And so they found a way to kind of walk this line where they're look the other way. I see something's going on down that hallway. I'm going to turn and go the other direction. But over time, making that kind of compromise got to them. They ended up, you know, becoming dependent on drugs, having panic attacks and all sorts of psychological problems because of it, and until they just had to leave the job.
Yeah. Well, Paul writes, I think police, correctional officers, or anyone else with legal power over others should be subject to double the usual punishment if convicted of assault or manslaughter, given the power imbalance. Val, I want to ask you, as you have gone through the process of telling your son's story, investigating it on your own because you've been unhappy with the way that his death was investigated, frustrated by the inaction of the higher-ups, as Julia is describing, and you even told the Sacramento Bee that your son was hazed to death, where are you now? How are you feeling about what happened to your son, the issues that led to his death, and where that puts you in the grieving process today?
That's a really hard question to answer. I mean, I drive down the road and think about that, and I could never really answer it myself, to be honest, because every day is different, you know. Some days I feel positive and some days not, you know. So I can't really answer that, you know. I mean, all this could have been completely different if, you know, I would have just got a phone call from the warden or somebody over there besides Kevin the warden that said, hey, let's sit down and let's talk about this. We're going to make sure this is done. And everybody on that book, you know, of the conduct would have been fired based off their own rules, and nothing was done. So there's just silence, you know, a lot of shoulder shrugging when I bring up points in meetings. It just you know, I really, what I did was I just experienced the dirty underbelly of CDCR and the people in charge, the management, supervisors, you know.
Well, Val, I can't thank you enough for telling us about your son, Valentino Rodriguez Jr. today. Valentino Rodriguez Sr., father of Val Rodriguez Jr., a whistleblower who worked at New Folsom Prison as a corrections officer. And Julie Small and Suki Lewis, thank you for bringing all of this to light and to life for us on your podcast, On Our Watch. My thanks also to Caroline Smith for producing today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.